Nearly 7 years ago, in February 2001, Bahrain introduced a series of reforms to open up its political system. The following year, the government unveiled a new constitution and issued calls for Sunni-Shia equality. Western governments hailed the country as a beacon for democracy in the Middle East. But two parliamentary elections later, Bahrain's liberal experiment appears to have failed to meet expectations. Tensions today are very high and the situation has become extremely volatile following the recent death of 31-year-old Ali Jassim, who was taking part in a peaceful protest on the Day of Martyrs. According to human rights campaigners, he was attacked by police, although the authorities say the protester was overcome by tear gas. Today's guests join us from America, Britain and Bahrain to talk about this tiny Persian Gulf state, which was described by George W. Bush as a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. My first guest can expand more on that statement since he comes from Washington, where ADHRB, Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, is based. Welcome to its director, Hussein Abdullah. Joining him from Bahrain is Dr. Abdul Jalil Al-Sangas, who is Director of Media and International Relations for HAC, the Movement of Liberties and Democracies, and Dr. Saeed Shahabi from the Bahrain Freedom Movement also brings his expertise to today's table. Well, that's the Bahrainis taken care of, and our fourth guest today is Shabir Razvi, who has recently returned from a major Bahrain property exhibition, and unlike our other guests, he thinks it's wrong for the state to be criticized for its land and property development ambitions. More of that later. But let me start with you first, Hussein. That comment made by George W. Bush, the American president, about Bahrain being a beacon of democracy, how accurate is that?
I don't think it's accurate. However, the Bahraini government would made a big deal of it. If you realize that Mr. Bush used that comment or made that comment only twice, and the State Department never made a big issue of it or emphasized on it, because later on, and rightly so, his advisors, President Bush's advisors, told him that Bahrain is not really a democracy, and if we use that as an example, we will be criticized heavily in the Middle East. Plus, you know, we will be mocked if that's used, because there are no serious changes or serious political reforms been taken in the country, and we don't want to take Bahrain or make Bahrain as an example of democracy, and it is not. That's why since 2002, he made that comment in 2002, and it was not even in a big set. It was a speech he gave at the NED. Since 2002, he never mentioned the word. I mean, he never made the statement that Bahrain is democracy. As a matter of fact, the State Department and the Bahraini embassy and the United States embassy in Bahrain announced to its citizens that they are really worried about the situation, the security situation in Bahrain, because of the recent riots in the country. So if you have a democracy, democracy always have a peaceful situation with its citizens, but it's not the case in Bahrain. So for a State Department warning its citizens to travel to Bahrain is actually contradict the previous statement that President Bush made only twice, and we have to put three lines under twice.
Dr. Abdul Jalil, when you return to Bahrain, preparations will be underway for George Bush to visit the island in February. What do you think he's going to say to the powers that be who are ruling Bahrain?
I think he would very much try to recall that statement, but he wouldn't be able to really say it again. It would be just some form of recollection, but also, I think, a regret. I would just very much would like to recall that the statement by George Bush in 2002 is one-off statement. In that day, in that year in particular, Reporters Without Frontiers issued its fourth index for freedom of expression. It positioned Bahrain at about 67, the position of 67, out of about 134 states. Now, that index kept indicating the deterioration of the situation in Bahrain. Now the position of Bahrain in this, in the that index amounts to what, 114 out of 169. You could very much tell the deterioration. So I think George Bush would be very much reluctant to really restate that. As a matter of fact, human rights organizations reports, international ones, in 2002 were very minimal. Now almost all major human rights organizations produce reports, statements, and they have Bahrain as a major chapter in their annual reports. So I think he would very much be keen to raise the human rights issue.
So, Dr. Saeed, I've got a statement here that Sherry Blair, the British Prime Minister's wife, obviously Tony Blair's since gone, but she said in 2003 that that King Hamad had made the kingdom the democratic and human rights pearl of the Arabian Gulf. That was her quote. What would you say to that?
Well, she couldn't be more wrong.
You see, I mean, she is by, you know, she has the reputation of being a great human rights lawyer.
When Sherry Blair went to Bahrain, we protested. We wrote her a long letter, lengthy letter, together with our friends in the UK. We tried to tell her our version of the story. She never acknowledged the receipt of these letters. She never tried to engage in a civilized debate about about the country. But
is it not really because there's just this minority group who are unhappy because they're not getting part of the wealth that's coming out of the development of Bahrain?
Let me tell you this. First of all, what we have in Bahrain today is a national struggle. It is a national struggle that aims at improving the freedom in the country, of a better or a fair distribution of wealth, a one-man, one-vote system we are declaring. And I challenge Sherry Blair or anyone else to tell me that in Bahrain today there exists a one-man, one-vote system. What we have is a hereditary dictatorship where rulership moves from the father or is inherited by the son from the father, and it goes on where you have no right to challenge the government, to change the government. The prime minister that whom we have today has been in his post for the past 36 years, since 1971, since the British withdrew from the Gulf in that year. Where we have out of 29 cabinet posts, 17 are occupied by members of the royal family, where we never had a former prime minister in our lifetime. So what democracy are we talking about? It is better for those, especially Sherry Blair, who I understood, she who asked a person with whom she was communicating not to make her lecture that she delivered in Bahrain public, because she would it would be a disaster for her if what she said became public, because simply she knew more than anyone else that what she said was wrong.
Well, let me go over to Shabir. You're a director of Finance Solutions Associates, and I've got here that you work with clients to create leading-edge property investment and business solutions. You've just recently been out to the Persian Gulf, where you've visited Dubai, Bahrain, and Iran. What sort of picture did you get when you went to Bahrain? Did you see this rioting and hear about this dissent? Is it a reality, or is it just a small minority of people who are unhappy?
Thank you very much. The week that I was there, which was the tail end of November, there was a big property exhibition. And I also sort of met up with my friends and so on in Bahrain. I attended one of the Friday prayers in a well-known location in Bahrain known as Diraz, where there was a huge congregation at Friday prayers.
Where I came from.
Is that so? Really?
Yes.
Well, I was there. And someone was going to come and visit me and take me for lunch from another place, Rifa, I think, which is on the other side. And they actually found it quite difficult because apparently there was a riot going on the high road, which is Budaya Highway, as far as I know. They couldn't. It took them about 2 to 3 hours to detour around the whole of island to come and see me. So obviously there is something going on. The other sort of aspect is that it was also the first anniversary of the death of Sheikh Jamri, which again I attended as condolences to this honorable scholar. And the whole ceremony was held in another village, which is, I think, across the road from your village. And I think in the evening there must have been at least 10,000 people attending. I mean, for a small island with not a huge population, I think 10,000 perhaps would translate to 500,000 in London.
And if you can just explain for our viewers who Sheikh Jamri was.
Well, I don't know if I'm in the best position to explain. He died last year. As far as I know, he was one of the leading scholars of Bahrain. Who spent a number of years in and out of prison in Bahrain for really challenging the manner in which the government is run, if you like, for want of a better word. If I may just come back on, you know, the property exhibition, obviously there's a lot of development taking place in Bahrain, huge, colossal developments. Business Bay, the World Trade Center, all kinds of, and the same thing is happening in Dubai, the same thing is happening in Qatar, all over the GCC countries. There is obviously huge amounts of petrodollars now coming in, and the wealthy people, the ruling families in that part of the world had a tendency of investing outside in UK or USA in the past. But since 9/11, a different strategy is taking place, if you like. They're investing more in the Indian subcontinent, in the Far East, and also in the local area. So a Kuwaiti may be buying huge properties in Dubai, an Emirati may be buying huge developments in Bahrain, and some Bahrainis may be buying in Oman and other places. So it's an interesting development that's taking place. The only tragedy, I think, is unlike in Britain or other democratic countries where the ruling prime minister or the chancellor of the exchequer can't say that I'm going to have this part of London as my private domain for development, whilst in the Middle East, that's what's happening. The ruling elites or the ruling families decide that this is my land and I'm going to develop it for my own personal...
What, they're grabbing the land in their own country?
Absolutely. So that's what I think is a bit of a difference in what is happening in Europe, America and other democracies
vis-a-vis
what's happening in the
GCC. I know that
country.
This has caused great concern with Lord Eric Avebury, the vice chair of the Parliamentary Human Rights Committee in Britain. He's well known of his defense of human rights, and this is what he had to say at a recent conference in the rather grand surroundings of the Moses Room in the House of Lords.
One year ago, when we met, our theme was elections without democracy or human rights, and we noted that in Bahrain there's a pretense of democracy, while all the sinews of government are bent to maintain the absolute rule of the Al Khalifa family with the assistance of others who benefit financially from the regime. Now, 12 months later, the people are still powerless, but there's a growing sense of resentment and a feeling that with no sign of progress towards equality, the rule of law, democracy, human rights, the situation is likely to become unstable, and there are already signs that that is occurring. Some people who don't belong to the exclusive Sunni tribe who hold all the political power have become very rich by collaboration with the regime and the dependable supporters of the status quo. Foreign immigrants have been and are still are being granted citizenship and jobs and houses, gradually marginalizing the native people and driving most of them downwards into further poverty. The king and the members of his family have taken control of several large islands, including those which were regained by Bahrain, through a decision of the International Court. And this annexation showed clearly that King Hamad regards the state of Bahrain as his own personal property. He and his uncle, the Prime Minister, have also enriched themselves by the sale of valuable land which has been reclaimed from the shallow seas adjacent to the capital, Manama. If I may quote from Property Development World, the Two Seas development is the creation of a luxury waterfront community located across 11 million square meters of man-made island, which will offer investors and potential residents the chance to own freehold property in Bahrain within a district dominated by state-of-the-art homes, recreational, retail and commercial space, and an expanse of manicured and landscaped gardens. It's the ruling family which controls the reclamation of land on which these developments are based, though of course the process is entirely opaque, like the rest of the royal accounts. Nobody demands that the king's finances and those of the royal family be open to public scrutiny, and still less that they should be subject to parliamentary control as they would be in a proper parliamentary democracy. That's a taboo subject. And so is the endemic discrimination against the Shia, who still, for the time being, form the majority of the population, though perhaps not for very much longer. The strategy of the Al-Khalifas is to continue with their demographic engineering until the Shia can be outvoted, so that the inequality of wealth and incomes, of opportunity and of political power can be maintained even if you do have free and fair elections in Bahrain. And in the meanwhile, the elections change nothing. After the last parliamentary elections in 2006, as you recall, the King reappointed the Prime Minister, who has now held that office continually for the last 37 years, and a cabinet, half of the members of which also belong to the Al-Khalifa family. The relatives occupied most of the prominent positions and portfolios, such as that of defence. And this incestuous system leads to corruption and skullduggery of the sort which was described by Dr. Salah Al-Banda, who's a British citizen who formerly worked for the government until he blew the whistle and was expelled from the country. He exposed Sheikh Ahmed bin Atiyat Allah Al-Khalifa, who is a minister and also a relative of the king, like so many others, as the centre of a multi-billion dinar conspiracy to manipulate the elections, foment sectarian disputes and distrust, and to keep the Shia down. And these criminal actions are tolerated and are still tolerated by the government to this day, as far as we are aware. What the authorities couldn't do was to rebut the 200 pages of evidence Dr. Albando published. So they just tried to blacken his name. They accused him of various unmentioned crimes and sought to discredit him by libels which didn't touch the real issues that he'd raised in his documents. So Bahrain evidently wants to be thought of as a state where human rights are respected, but doesn't have any real intention of complying with international human rights norms.
Well, some serious allegations made there against the Bahraini ruling family. I did actually contact the Bahrain Embassy in London and offer them a place on this show to give their side of the story. I'm still waiting for a response, but that could be down to the festive period. If they do want to respond, you know, we can give their response in a later program. But Dr. Abdul-Jalil, we saw you at that conference there organised in London. Why was London chosen as the venue?
Well, London is very well known for its exposure to the rest of the world. There are many main media establishments here. There are many human rights organizations. Considering London as its headquarters, we believe that by holding the activity here, we will be able to reach the rest of the world.
Now, those graphic images behind Lord Avebury were of the young man who died in the march just recently in Bahrain.
Yes. Yes, this young man, newly married man, he was just participating in a peaceful demonstration. It's an annual commemoration of the Martyrs' Day. They were prevented by the death squads, the Bahrain death squads, to get to the place where the demonstration.
The Bahrain death squad. Surely that's an exaggeration.
Well, no, it is not. You could tell that from the way this young man was treated. He's armless, yet he was surrounded by a few of those mercenaries, and he was beaten to death.
Well, we're heading towards a break now, and when we come out of the break, we will be discussing that, the issue of sectarianism, and further issues about this Persian Gulf state. As I said, we're about to go into a break now, but before we do, I'd like to ask you a question. What does the name Bahrain mean? I'll give you the answer after this break, so do stay tuned. Welcome back to today's edition of The Agenda with me, Yvonne Ridley, and my guests Shabir Razvi, Hussein Abdullah, Dr. Saeed Shahabi, and Dr. Abdul-Jalil Alsengres. As we went into the break, I asked, what does Bahrain's name mean? Well, it means two seas, and I think all of the guests guessed that one. It was once viewed by the ancient Sumerians as an island paradise to which the wise and the brave were taken to enjoy eternal life. Now, coming back to you, Dr. Abdul-Jalil, an island paradise, this is the term that Western developers use, and I noticed you bristling there when Shabir was talking about this Western development.
Yes, it is paradise, but not for Bahrainis. It is paradise, but not for nationals. It is meant to have in fortune, as correctly said by Shabir, but it is not, this fortune is not meant to be distributed among people or improve their living standards or, you know, their livelihood.
Well, realistically speaking, where do the wealthy redistribute their riches?
Well,
I can't think of a country in the world.
Then they should not really say that this wealth is going back to Bahrain. This is what the authorities have been saying, that we are creating this mega projects and investments to improve the living standards.
Well, it's called the trickle-down effect, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, Shabir was stating that he was in Duraz. Duraz, one of the biggest villages in Bahrain, made of several thousands of Bahrainis. Yet, and we are in the 21st century, there are no asphalt road. As a matter of fact, he should have recognized the dust coming out when a car passing by. There are no sewage system, no infrastructure. Imagine, this billion projects is not going back to improve the situation, the livelihood situation in Bahrain. It is meant to make the richest richer. And it's only few figures, namely the ruler, his sons, and the prime minister, who are just taking this fortune coming to Bahrain.
Can I add something to what both have said? And what you just read about the old times paradise status of Bahrain. Yes, it was. There were springs, freshwater springs, more than 80 or 100 springs in the good old days. There were good, very nice coral reefs where very beautiful fish was living and had sanctuary there. There were groves, date palm groves, all over the place. It was called the land of the million palm date palms. Where are they? Where is it? There is desertification. All the green is being destroyed. The coral reef is being completely destroyed. The habitat, the natural habitat for fish, is being destroyed because of the reclamation of
sea land. So why aren't we hearing this from environmental groups? You know, we hear very, very little about Bahrain as a whole.
Well, in fact, only a few months ago, many people were taken ill to hospitals because of the amount of fumes and gases coming out of industrial units related to oil and industry. Why didn't people speak about it? Of course, because of the there. At the moment, we have a lot of money being invested in public relations. Within the UK, there are so many or several companies, some of them including members of the House from the House of Lords, who are being paid heavily. One of them last week came to me and suggested that an injured man may have inflicted the wound on himself. I said, "Are you mad? What are you? You are supposed to be a member of the, you are supposed to be a peer, a member of the House of Lords. How much money is being given to you?" He smiled and he went away. So, and yesterday, one of a member of his staff was well.
I would like to, if I may, I would like to add one thing. You want to go ahead?
No, I was going to say that in a recent meeting that we had, a member of his staff was present and she was taking notes. One day I told her, we'll give you the whole notes. There is nothing secret to be discussed here. What I'm saying is that there is a big propaganda machine which is fed and fueled by this huge money of oil, which at the moment we are getting around $7 billion a year, out of which only less than that goes to the budget, and more than half of it is off budget.
Well, another area that I want to look at is this issue of sectarianism, and I asked the extremely influential Bahraini Sunni Sheikh Isa Al-Jauda if this was indeed a sectarian issue. This is what he had to say.
The issue concerns the Bahrain nation as a whole. And when I say the nation of Bahrain, I mean the Sunni and the Shia and the various other factions. The problem itself stems from the regime, which finds parties to support them in the spreading of sectarianism. However, sectarianism has been studied and considered, and it will not succeed in the future. Every time sectarianism has come to the surface, there are those that have followed it with their minds and merciful hearts and great ideas, though this only ever lasts a few days. I believe that there are enough influences to put a stop to the evils of sectarianism.
ولكنها لا يمكن أن تنجح في يوم من الأيام.
Hussein, could I have your views on that, please, about this? Is it just too easy to blame sectarianism, with the ruling family being Sunni and the majority of Bahrainis being Shia?
No, absolutely not. It's not a sectarian issue at all. And you just mentioned, we just seen Sheikh Isa al-Jodar. Sheikh Isa al-Jodar is a well-known Sunni figure, Islamic Sunni figure in the country. His oldest daughter is married to a Shia man. Sunni and Shia have been living for years side by side in Bahrain. And it was never an issue of sectarianism. The issue is between the people of Bahrain. And I'm repeating here, the people of Bahrain as a one nation and the ruling family who are treating the people of Bahrain as a personal property.
So these rioters, they're mixed?
They're mixed. If you paid attention to those pictures behind Sheikh Isa al-Jodar or Lord Ifbri, they are not the blood of Shia or blood of Sunni. Those are the blood of the people of Bahrain. And also, one of the points that Lord Ifbri mentioned or said or raised that there are raising riots in the country. Actually, what we've seen in the past recent days that people of Bahrain, especially the youth, are telling the ruling family that we are no longer going to stay silent. We are going to take on upon ourselves to come to the street peacefully and tell you and tell the world that what we need in Bahrain, we need democracy, we need justice.
Well, they can shout all they want, but we're not hearing about it. It's not going in the media. Why is that?
No, actually, for us being here discussing the issue is one of the results of what happened. One of the results of what happened to Mr. Ali Jassim, who gave his life for a noble cause. And he will be remembered by the people of Bahrain, but those who killed him will not. And for our organization to be in the United States is also a result of the resiliency of the people of Bahrain, especially the youth.
But is the American administration seriously going to listen to you? I mean, Bahrain, let's not forget, is home to the Fifth Fleet.
The American administration is going to listen to us because it's in the interest of the United States to support a democratic movement in Bahrain, because we don't want to see tension in the country. Yes, it is the base of the Fifth Fleet, but they want the base to be in a stable country, not in a country where the Al Khalifa dictator rule is making it into an unstable country by torturing and putting people in jail and killing innocent people. So yes, they would listen. It just take an effort. And I believe the effort started from inside, from the Haq movement, and from several organizations outside, whether they are Bahraini or human rights organizations.
Shabir, somebody comes to your business and they want to take out a loan to buy a luxury property in Bahrain. What are you going to say to them? Are you going to tell them about the allegations that we've heard today?
That's a very interesting question, and you put me on a real spot there. Do I wear my businessman's hat or a socially conscious entrepreneur's hat, if you like? I think the whole issue is really very complex. Complex in the sense that global situation concerning wealth and those who do not have wealth are prevalent virtually everywhere. And I think this is the whole tragedy, that my Bahrain doesn't come on the radar of lots of other issues that are happening globally, because it's a small place, okay, the Fifth Fleet is there, and all kinds of issues, but there are colossal disparities between wealth and those who do not have. Whether you go to India, you see, you know, five-star hotels in Bombay, and people are sleeping on the street. You know, that makes good a documentary. It makes sort of, you know, good visual impact on the
people. So you're saying it's a matter of fact, just get on with it and deal with it?
No, what I'm saying is that invariably it's a process of education to inform the people that there are certain countries that there are problems, and perhaps it's not wise or sensible for the investor to invest in those countries, because they may be contributing to the virtual disparities that are going on. However, at the end of the day, it's not a particularly unique Bahrain issue. That's what I'm trying to sort of say.
Now, what you did say that upsets the studio guests, you said, look, guys, you're fighting the wrong fight here. You should be focusing on human rights, not on the development that is going on in Bahrain.
Yeah, my comment yesterday was, in a way, trying to let them really focus. Being a non-Bahraini, as an observer who visits Bahrain regularly, to really inform them that perhaps they should move to a different level. Okay, disparity between wealth and non-wealth does create human rights issues, but they are not really that attractive for the mass audience globally to understand, because they said this is happening in the Amazon, this is happening wherever. So they really have to focus on the human rights abuses, the lack of democracy, and really the ruling elite profiting from whatever is happening in Bahrain.
Can I just make an intervention here from two aspects? The first is the issue of information moving from the inside to the rest of the world. Mind you, the tactic used by the authorities is to devise laws to rule. It's ruling by laws. Laws are used to hush and silence journalists. Laws are used to block homepages and sites, and even human rights organization sites. Laws are used to make unionists redundant. Laws are used to ensure that this money pours in but goes to those elite, the ruling elite, mainly the prime minister and his son-in-law, king, Sheikh Hamad. And laws are used to make sure that no assembly is allowed, no speaking is allowed, no seminar is allowed. So it's not easy.
Not the qualities you'd expect in a democracy.
No, ma'am. As a matter of fact, this is the new tactic. Earlier, they used just to barge in and ensure that nobody, and taking away, and nobody in the world will hear about you. But because of this diversity of technology, they know that somebody else could easily reach that technology. So
with all due respect, though, you're sitting here quite openly and freely speaking, and yet the picture you're creating, you know, I fear for you when you go back to Bahrain.
Well, I mean, it's a duty I have to do. Somebody else, I mean, this young man has already paid his life for just to express his view. It's a duty that I have to do, similar to others. I want to really to relate to the sectarian issue. And Haq movement, Sheikh Isa, whom you have displayed his statement, is the vice chairman of Haq movement. And Haq movement, we're trying to really to break that myth, which is trying to, the authorities trying to convey to the rest of the world that there is a sectarian issue which is governing, even forming organizations. And it's an issue which dissidents are divided about. No, it's not. As a matter of fact, it's the ruling family which is pouring, well, dedicating millions of dinars to introduce sedition, sectarian sedition, and that is the main issue of Al-Bandar's case. When he blew the whistle on this issue, he was, extradited the second day. He was taken to UK. So it's the ruling family, mainly the royal court, is governing a secret organization, introducing sedition between the nationals, trying to make conversion from Shia to Sunni, paying others to write about sectarian issues. As a matter of fact, they introduce a newspaper, full newspaper, just to speak about sectarian issue and sort of flame the sentiment between the nationals, between Sunni and Shia. So to us, we have not ever in the past history of opposition or as activists made a demand or a call related to Shia Sunni. It's all national.
Well, as I said before, we did try through the Bahrain Embassy in London to get someone to make a comment or rebut allegations that had been made. But someone who is independent, who has taken a keen interest in the political landscape of Bahrain, is Jane Kinnamont, who works for the London-based Economist Intelligence Unit. This is her assessment.
I just came back from Bahrain last month, and I think some of the concerns that have been aired today are very much in line with things that I was hearing in Bahrain. There's been ongoing tensions about the discrimination issue for many years. Now, at the moment, you do have quite high economic growth with the high oil price, but that's also leading to tensions about how this is being distributed. These real estate developments that Abdul Jalil al-Sangeh was highlighting are very visible. They're the most dramatic thing that you see in Bahrain. And meanwhile, people are complaining that they can't get a housing loan from the government. It's very difficult to get a mortgage in Bahrain. So this housing issue, I think, is really a widespread concern for less well-off people in Bahrain, whether they are Sunni or Shia. You do see this kind of inequality all over the world, as somebody raised, and it becomes difficult to get international attention. Another issue is that there isn't a lot of reporting about the unrest that's coming out of Bahrain. There has been more, I think, in recent years, partly because you have a very active local blogging community who are publicising things, but the local press does tend to play it very safe. There's extensive self-censorship, and so there are frequently riots or protests that are just not covered by the press. We found one quite interesting example of a paper that was trying to find a creative way of slipping it in that these riots were happening when they interviewed a man from a rubbish collection firm who was complaining that his bins were being damaged, and he happened to mention this was because there was frequent rioting in his area. But, for example, yesterday looking on the Google News searches or looking at Reuters news searches, there was very little about the ongoing protests, rioting, the death of this protester, has been reported by AP. But generally, you're getting much more business stories coming out of Bahrain.
Should the international community be concerned, and what can it do?
I guess I don't want to say anything prescriptive about government policy, but I would say that for people that are, say, looking to invest in Bahrain, it is one of the most stable countries in the region, and I think that generally people don't want to return to the levels of violence that we've seen in the 1990s, but it is important to try and get an in-depth sense of the tensions that are bubbling under the surface.
Dr. Saeed, that was an independent assessment there. What are you hoping will be achieved by the meeting in the House of Lords that Lord Avebury held, and how are you going to create pressure to get the sort of justice that you were talking about at this meeting?
Well, first of all, we have been struggling against the regime for the past four decades. Personally, the first time I went to the streets was in 1965, and then from on from then on, I continued my struggle, and so are my friends and my colleagues here and inside the country.
But haven't things improved since the new Charter for Democracy was brought out in 2001, 2002?
To me, from the very first day when I went back to Bahrain in 2001, that was the first and last time that I went in 22 years, I immediately realized that what we were seeing was more of a deception rather than a genuine political reform program. And today, the events are showing that that is right, that's the true picture, that what we are seeing today is much worse than what we had seen in the past. More money is being plundered, more land is being confiscated. The demography of the country is being fundamentally changed and permanently altered, and the landscape of politics is being hijacked by the government and not opened up to the public.
Hussein, you'll obviously be trying to get some influence in the White House before George Bush makes his visit in February. Again, how confident are you of getting American influence brought to bear on the authorities in Bahrain?
I'm very confident that myself and the member that we have in our organization will do our absolute best to bring about any change we could in the mentality of the American administration. We already see some hope, we see some light in the Congress, and we believe that hope will be transferred in the White House, that there is a tension in Bahrain that needs to be addressed before it's get bigger and it will become a security quagmire in the country, which the American administration does not want.
I'm sure that this discussion could go on, but unfortunately our journey has come to an end today. Do you agree with our guests, or do you have your own views on the situation in Bahrain? Send us your feedback to the email address shown on the screen now. That's theagenda@presstv.com. The best emails will be read out, especially if they're like the one sent by Donna Debash from Calgary in Canada. She described the Agenda's discussion and analysis on the latest Osama bin Laden tape as awesome. Thank you for that. And Stephen Fry in Sao Paulo, Brazil, enjoyed our show on the US presidential elections and would like us to give more airtime to Ron Paul. He wrote, "The future of the world is hanging in the balance, and it's up to those in the media to take responsibility for the war that they have helped create and perpetuate, and indeed it is up to all of us to do whatever we can to make our voices heard." So thank you for that. If you missed the last agenda, you can see it on our archives by going to www.presstv.com. And finally, a very big thank you to all of our guests, and we'll see you all soon. Thank you.